Anaxagoras 7. 10 May 1968. Chimera begins. All subjects were assembled and introduced to room 3SSB, crowding onto chairs taken from other rooms so that all could be seated. Howard and I presented our undertaking. I explained the background with discussion of my previous research and the issues raised by it. Howard summarized the findings of our survey. I explained the selection process for the multiples, what we were looking for. Howard showed them the observation room with its bed, the instruments, the two-way mirror, and so on. I explained the purpose of the instruments, the nature of the data to be collected, the reason for its collection. We discussed how each subject would be scheduled, and we invited each of them to come and stay in the room overnight to sleep in it, to become more comfortable with it, and show them the refrigerator we had stocked with sodas, juices, milk, and other things to eat, to make their stay comfortable, the hot plate and the tea kettle. We assured them they could lock the door, listen to the radio, sleep, study. We want them to feel the environment is safe and comfortable. One of the subjects after the meeting confided that she did not think she wanted to continue. I expressed my regret and understanding, and I told her she could return if she wished and certainly should feel welcome to speak to me any time about the research and what we are finding. I hope that she will do so. She was a promising subject, but she has a certain anxiety about the matter because of religious upbringing. She intimated that she thought we were seeking to possess knowledge that we should not ask for. Zoe, of course, was the first to volunteer to stay in 3SSB. She will stay tonight. Howard will go with the key later tonight to let her in. 11 May, 1968. I'm guessing, of course, however inferring from Howard's sheepishness and awkward nervousness today, I think he stayed with Zoe in the room at 3SSB last night. I did not ask. Such things happen. I should be careful, however, that this does not interfere with our research. Howard has received his military induction notice. He must report for his physical to the Selective Service in middle of June. He has not decided what to do about conscription, but has wisely decided to attend the physical at any rate. We shall employ EEG for baseline data. In our studies of sleep and dreams in clinical situations, EEG, electroencephalograph, has been employed to record electrical activity across the scalp produced by the firing of neurons within the brain. Abnormal EEG brain signals have been associated with identified psychological disorders of supposed biological origin, as is the probable case for schizophrenia, certain dementias, possibly depression. There are 5 signal EEG wave patterns that we currently distinguish. From lowest states of consciousness, as it were, to the highest, these are delta, up to 3 hertz, the highest in amplitude, and the slowest. It is the wave seen in adults in normal sleep. Deep, dreamless sleep takes you to the lowest frequency, typically 2 or 3 cycles a second. 0 is brain death. Theta, 4 hertz to 7, seen in healthy, playful young children, but also seen in the drowsiness of adults, or sometimes in an alert older child. An excess theta for a certain age represents abnormal activity. It is a strange brainwave state. Hypnosis and the barely conscious states just above sleeping or just after waking are associated with it. Theta is the twilight between the conscious and the subconscious. It is the cliff upon waking or the abyss beneath it. Alpha, 8 hertz to 12, is brought out by closing the eyes and relaxation. but the person is usually alert. A person who has completed a task and sits down to rest is often in an alpha state. Alpha can be normal. It can be abnormal, especially in the prolonged cycle, such as, for example, when found in a coma. Beta, 12 hertz to 30. When the brain is aroused, eyes open, and the person is actively engaged in mental or physical activities, it generates beta waves. This is, in effect, the common normal conscious state of ourselves. Beta waves are of relatively low amplitude and are the fastest of the brain waves. Beta waves are characteristically of a strongly engaged mind. A person in an active conversation would be in a low to a mid beta range. A heated argument would lie in a high beta. Gamma, 30 hertz to 100. These are highly energetic, typically dispersed wave patterns, that is, they are spread across the entire array of electrode sensors on the scalp, as if the whole brain were involved in their activity. The rhythms are thought to represent intensive cognitive or motor function. Gamma waves are poorly understood, only recently discovered. We do not really know the role or effect of these waves, and they are not found often. Essentially, our research shall utilize the same instruments of measurement for physiological data that we have applied to sleep and dream research in the past. The sleep and dream research performed here at the university since the mid-1950s by Dr. Rand and others has provided us a baseline for states of dreams and sleep. Normal sleep with ordinary dreaming begins with delta waves, lifts up to alpha, then migrates to or alternates with beta waves, like normal waking, when the REM is observed. Thence, the subject will drop back to delta wave patterns. During REM, several other physiological changes also take place, in addition to the characteristic rapid eye movement under the lids. The heart rate and breathing quickens, the blood pressure rises, body temperature is not well regulated. But the rest of the body is essentially paralyzed until one leaves REM sleep. This paralysis is similar to hypnagogic hallucination, except that in that hallucinatory state, one is awake and feels paralyzed, as if the body is still asleep, but the eyes are open and one can talk and think as normal. Exomatic experience may prove to be some sort of hybrid of dreaming and the hypnagogic hallucination. As each subject attempts to induce exomatic experience, we shall collate brainwave patterns with other data such as GSR. We shall monitor temperature, heart rate, blood pressure, and the REM as we do in routine sleep dream studies. To these data sets, we will correlate narratives, the contemporaneous observations of the subject by way of the two-way mirror, and finally, the reported experience of the subject. The narrative of the subject is highly subjective. Unless we find other ways to corroborate the experience, any reported incidents may be impossible to validly confirm. We know that the duration of these experiences is often very brief and may not even be detected by data monitors. We also know that the sense of time for the subjects during such experiences is impaired. We shall have to see what we can do. But first, we need to establish what, if any, physiological patterns we should find. However, the paramount issue of this research, what must be resolved, is not going to be settled by discerning physiological characteristics, interesting though they may be. The issue is, can we validate the perception? That is, may we determine that the percipient is truly in two places at the same time? 15 May, 1968. Zoe has asked, and I unhesitatingly assented, to permit a friend of hers to join her while she lives in my home. I'm thinking that because I have so many rooms, this storied Victorian townhouse was once the home of a family of eight, I am told, and included additionally domiciles for two maids, a governess, a cook, and a groomsman, who tended the garden and did the heavy lifting. Altogether, there may be 12 bedrooms here. I'm thinking to invite all of the multiples to come live here this summer. It may be helpful to the research. It would be a new experience for me. Zoe thinks it's a good idea and has begun encouraging them to come and stay with us. Otherwise, they all may depart soon for the summer or be obliged to work and find it difficult to participate in our research. Zoe's friend will share her room with her, though they have but a single bed between them. She's a clever girl, not in school. They met at the bar, and Zoe says glowingly admiring things about her. She's much older than Zoe. She rather dominates their conversation, which I should think is like telling Tinkerbell not to fly. So her words must be some magic. I do not understand their relationship. Until later this day, when I came into the kitchen for my tea kettle and found her embracing Zoe and kissing her on the mouth. Well, this is not a thing I do not understand. I do not know where this puts Howard, but perhaps it removes certain complications I had hoped to avoid anyway. Her young friend, or perhaps I should say petite âme, as the Parisians say, is named Rachel. She is, when I think of it, more coarsely featured than Zoe, big-bosomed, if not to say chubby, and she obviously does not wear a brassiere. I think for her it should be an improvement in appearance. She can be bossy, I think, but she is courteous to me and always helpful in the kitchen. Bugger likes her very much. Rachel organizes consciousness-raising events, which are in much demand on campus, many held at the chapel in association with the Unitarians, of which she is a member. She is, as I say, quite bright, although she did not graduate. I found that her school record was excellent, and, well, forgive me, I do have motherly affections for Zoe. She had majored in political science. She has the latest important books on the window ledge of her there room, Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, and Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, and Marcuse's One-Dimensional Man. She can make the distinction between Trotskyites and Stalinists, and considers herself one of the former. Although to be either in America is to beg unnecessary confrontation and useless ill-tempered dialogue, but I think she likes useless ill-tempered dialogue. She will even argue with the television. "Why don't you have a color TV?" she challenged me one day. Sarcastically, I thought. Although she really likes to watch TV, so I could not be sure. I said, "Reality is black and white to me, so I like to see the way it is." She saw no humor in the remark, but said that wealthy Americans who had color TV did not see the people of color even in them. A clever, if not whimsical, observation. And when the television is on, and she almost always leaves it on, in the way I remember my father always had the fireplace throbbing embers, she will play music very loudly on my stereo. Jefferson Airplane, Jimi Hendrix. I think my neighbors must think I am a changed person. 25 May, 1968. The girls have completed pre-flight training. Some have taken a first flight under our observation. Some have not got off the ground. In our journal of each incident, we shall identify each by a pseudonym, the key for which shall be kept in my safety deposit box at my bank, to which only the chair now has access in the event of my death. The pseudonyms were assigned by Howard: Alice, A, White Rabbit, WR, Cheshire Cat, CC, Caterpillar, W for Worm, Mock Turtle, MT, and Griffin, G. Harold says, of course, I must be the Mad Hatter, and he must be my Dormouse. And she who got away? who declined late in the day, he said that she shall be known as the Queen of Hearts. Should she return, I teased Howard, telling him that we should be found to be unprofessional. He almost believed me, but I did insist. The Queen of Hearts, that ought to be Dr. Winslow, I think. The one who got away, she shall be our hedgehog. So it was decided that the one who left prematurely would be identified as Hedgehog, H, should she return. Alice took the first flight. Easy for her, it seemed. We got our first clear measurements. Cheshire Cat came in and out a bit. Caterpillar did not get off the ground, but was profoundly relaxed in a deep meditation on her bed. Griffin had a little sore across the room, she said. Some special psychic phenomenon which these multiples previously reported should be addressed in our preliminary consideration, reflecting capacities of some advanced development of the skill of exomatic experience, perhaps, but which also did appear incidental even in some of the naive singles. First, the capacity to travel by way of intention from place to place in an instant. Of our six, two have said they feel the capacity but have not exercised it. Three others have said they have employed it successfully, merely thinking of a person or a place, and they find themselves there. Our Cheshire Cat is particularly adept. Alice is able to do this also. Griffin said she did this also but found it uncomfortable. She worried whether she should find her way back to her body. Second is the feeling of powers to influence in addition to movement. All of our girls can travel, though only the three by mere intent. They all can float, fly, more or less quickly or slowly as it suits them, although our caterpillar does not like to go quickly and prefers to stay near to her bed. But additionally, four of them, Alice, Cheshire Cat, Griffin, and White Rabbit, said they may rearrange things in rooms in which they find themselves. As it were by telekinesis, although none of them conceived it as such, this is the most underdeveloped psychic capacity among them. The White Rabbit found herself, however, on two occasions having packed her book bags in this state, although having distinctly recalled not having done so the night before. This may be an uncertain phenomenon, but should prove itself readily verifiable by experiment. Finally, some of the girls perceive or believe in profound, heightened awareness to see whatever one wants, to understand without effort. Griffin certainly insists this, saying that often she employed this state to resolve difficult matters that she had been working on and can wake up and write cogently for hours afterwards, recalling the insights that she gained. Cheshire Cat also claims a similar capacity, but that it appears for her by insights into other people's lives, realizing, for instance, that an old friend of hers is getting married before she received the announcement, or knowing by sudden clarity that her mother was gravely ill before she got the phone call that rang in the hall. Alice says sometimes she thinks she knows things when she is in an exomatic state, but cannot remember them when she awakes. It may be a capacity that is cultivated. 2 June, 1968. It was an extraordinarily warm day, reaching almost 90 degrees in the shade and no rain expected for a few days, when then a cold front should return more seasonable temperatures. But perhaps it was this tropical warmth which explains the adventure, and of course the influence of intoxicants, high spirits, and goodwill. All the girls have moved in to stay the summer. Griffin and Mock Turtle, who share an apartment during the school year, have come just yesterday, while the others have been here for a week or more. Rachel decided to organize among us, in lieu of church, I suppose, a consciousness-raising event, a be-in, as she called it. She insisted upon our assembly in the living room, and uncharacteristically, the TV was turned off, the stereo not playing. When she wishes the attention of others, she will insist on this focused silence upon her. But not so when others wish to speak, I have observed. Certainly, I shall have to be more assertive on my own behalf and on behalf of others if this community is to preserve its equanimity. Rachel began with the reading from Friedan, to wit, her provocative opening paragraph in The Feminine Mystique. The problem lay buried, unspoken, for many years in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone. As she made the beds, stopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night. She was afraid to ask, even of herself, the silent question, "Is this all?" My perspective I kept to myself, for I am older and not an American, and this passage seems particularly addressed to American women, and especially those college-educated women of the post-war era. The banal existential nausea was admitted by all of them, almost without exception, except for one. They are uncertain that they want to marry. They feel that most men do not respect the feelings that they have, the ideas they express, their ambitions, their sexual needs, their dignity. They almost all feel their fathers were domineering and abrupt, and their mothers weak and subservient. Except for Zoe, who tells us she did not know her father, and that her mother is a dancer. "What sort of dance?" asked White Rabbit. Rachel changed the subject. She wanted to know if we wanted to be mothers. Curious question in my presence, I thought, since I'm menopausal. But I've resigned myself to this. Griffin said, "Absolutely not." Caterpillar said, "She could not imagine it." Mock Turtle said, "She did not expect to ever get married." Zoe gushed, "Of course I shall have children. I shall have lots of them." Rachel said to her, "That's insane. Are you a cow?" Zoe replied, "Children are beautiful. I loved being a child. I shall love to have children." Rachel said, "Childbearing is manacle to the patriarch. Motherhood is bondage." I bit my tongue. White Rabbit nodded agreement. Mock Turtle said, "It's sadly true," and sighed. Griffin told Zoe she should certainly forsake her own career should she undertake motherhood and a husband. Zoe said, "Who said anything about a husband?" This, I think, redeemed her. Rachel beamed. Mock Turtle worried. Caterpillar said that it should be difficult without a man. All laughed. I intervened. "Your namesake, Zoe, your true namesake, Josephine Baker. I have told you about her. The Negress dancer from Harlem, who expatriated to France and became famous, and who, like your mother, is an exotic and liberated woman. She has no children of her own. But she adopted 12 multi-ethnic orphans. She calls them her rainbow tribe." "Yes," said Rachel. "Yes," said Griffin. "I don't know," said Zoe. "I like fucking men." "Well, of course you do," I said. "But remember, you are free to live your life as you please." The girls looked at me admiringly. Caterpillar took out a hash pipe and a tin foil package of hash, beginning to unwrap it while some girls looked at me anxiously. I had not expected a holy sacrament at our church service. But I am neither innocent nor prudish. The laws concerning drugs in America are absurd. I considered some cautioning words, but understood that a special mood, a moment of intimacy had been achieved, and I did not want to disturb it. So I said merrily, "Oh my, I've never tried hashish." and this was taken for permission, and it was promised that I should enjoy it. I have, of course, ingested derivative or synthetic TCP and some other psychotropic drugs as part of my research in hallucinations, but small quantities merely, and as I recall, except for relaxation, the TCP had no significant effect upon me. Caterpillar passed the pipe. It had a nice floral aroma. It tasted rather like licorice, I thought. Everyone took a toke, took two, took three. Conversation was suspended as if it were truly a sacrament. Zoe was the first to acknowledge the effects, flushing and sighing and laughing. The others laughed too, either sympathetically or because they also felt the giddy feeling that she did. I felt pleasant. Perhaps things seemed mildly glimmering. What I felt mostly was that time slowed down. I think I remember this from before. It's a very different sensation than alcohol, in which time seems frenetic, or one feels numb to it. Here, time is the essence of the perception, perceiving time as, I say, a tree must, I thought, patiently. Sensing the slow-motion arc of the sun, his warm illumination is felt from this side to the other. Rachel declared we should all take off our clothes. Zoe enthused, yes, yes, and she did. And so did Rachel. And Caterpillar began, and so did Griffin, and because she did so, hesitantly did Mock Turtle. It was something they must often do, it seemed, when they were stoned, or so I supposed in a silly thought. But this was the same ritual nudism that my mother practiced some Sundays, and I had sometimes joined her then, when I was a girl, although my father never did, that I can remember. So I undressed, and then so did White Rabbit, seeing that I did. Mock Turtle still wore her underpants, but everyone else, including myself, were quite nude to our bare feet. It felt very nice. Oh, wonderful, variously shaped, wonderfully differently hued the features and the skin is of the naked woman. One so distinct from another. And how beautiful are these girls, so sensuous their young bodies, and how sad they do not know how beautiful they are. You can see the self-doubt worrying them in their eyes, except for Zoe, who enjoys her own nakedness. She enjoys everything about herself. Her eyes scintillate her joy. I said, "We should have cocktails." "Gin and tonics or martinis?" I asked. "Both," Zoe happily decided. "Yes, of course, why not?" So I prepared martinis as my father had taught me, and Zoe helped me set out cocktail glasses on the coffee table on my silver tea service, and I put colossal olives into a crystal bowl with pickle fork and mixed a carafe of gin and tonic and brought highball glasses and slices of lime on a plate. Mock Turtle did not drink, but everyone else tried at least one of each. I went to the piano and took out my Cole Porter songbook. I sang as I played.
Times have changed. And we've often rewound the clock since the Puritans got a shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock. If today any shock they should try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Rock won't land on them. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now, heaven knows, anything goes. Good authors, too, who once knew better words, now only use four-letter words. Writing prose, anything goes.
Saying your prayers,
saying your prayers you like.
phone rang. As we continued singing from the songbook, Zoe ran to the phone on the wall of the kitchen and answered it. "It's Howard," she called to us. "He's in California." I got up to answer the phone, and Cheshire Cat took my place at the piano to play a ragtime. "We are all naked, Howard," I heard Zoe tell him. "You should be here." She listened to him. "Well, of course, you should be nude, too." I took the phone from her. "Howard, is that you?" He did not ask me if I was nude as well. I supposed he guessed it was just she. He had gone to help the McCarthy campaign in the California primary. He said that it looked like Kennedy may win, but McCarthy was gaining, and Humphrey was not placing at all. While I was talking on the phone, Rachel turned on the stereo, drowning out Cheshire Cat's really excellent left hand, with Grace Slick singing, "When the truth is found to be lies and all the joy within you dies, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love?" Rachel's song, a downer, as they say. The girls looked annoyed, so I suggested to all of them gaily, "Let's go into the garden. Zoe, bring the cocktails, my dear." Rachel stayed behind with her music, and I was glad of it. I shut the door to the house, and her music was muffled. Muffled enough that the song of the chatting birds was clear and cheerful to hear, and the air was more richly suffused with roses than I had ever remembered it. "Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, old time is still a-flying, and this same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying." "Let's do tea," I said, after a second martini. I had so intended anyway, nude or no, intoxicated or no. I had purchased the Lady Godiva chocolates, how appropriate. The wafer cookies, petit fours, cream puffs, and eclairs. And I had previously arrayed them. Zoe brought out the presentation of them as I made the tea in the kitchen, defying the lyrics of Grace Slick. It was a second nature to me, but I was enthralled with the ritual of it, the steam softly flushing the air, the pouring of the boiling water burbling into the pot, the dark coloration from the fragrant tea, an expensive Darjeeling, my mother's favorite. How appropriate. We had tea at home just like this when we were nude, as I remembered, this very tea which my mother made. I had put out the table in the morning, had brought out and placed my 8 folding chairs, put a linen tablecloth on the table, had put rocks on the tablecloth to hold down the cloth so that it would not blow away. Of course, I had not expected a nude tea party. But the umbrella of the basswood shades us in the yard, and none of us should be sunburnt. And it is such a warm day, none of us shall be cold, so why not stay nude all day? Under the basswood we were drenched with the perfume of its blossoming, an aural orb surrounding us of this almost wet scent. The garden has many bubbles of such sensualities, roses, basswood, lilacs, and bees who shall make honey from the basswood blossoms were everywhere in the tree, darting, drifting, like bits of loving energy, working, kissing, kissing, working, murmuring among the quiet green leaves, humming happily. "Shall I be mother?" I asked the girls and poured their teas. Everyone was happy. Mock Turtle wondered, "Why are there 8 chairs?" "What is that, my dear?" "There are only 6 of us. Why are there 8 chairs? Are you expecting anyone?" She looked worried at the thought of it. Zoe said, "I think we all need to change chairs then so none of them are unoccupied." So everyone but Mock Turtle got up and changed seats and passed to one another their teacups, except Mock Turtle, who seriously said, "I don't see what difference that makes." It makes all the difference in the world, I said, and changed chairs again, and so did everyone else except Mop Turtle, who shook her head with tears coming to her eyes and says, I don't think that this is at all funny. I think you need another toque, said Caterpillar. And she laughed to realize, feeling her bare thighs, that she did not have a pocket, but ran back into the house with Zoe to fetch the hash pipe. When she returned with it, Zoe told me moodily that Rachel would not come out. I said, that's just as well. The March Hare should not have invited her to sit in the first place. She did not know what I meant. Zoe, said Caterpillar, come taste some of this. Oh, come on this side, motioning for her to come over where she sat with White Rabbit. They exchanged the pipe among themselves and blissed out, I should say. I ate a cream puff. The first of all my life, it felt, I ate it like I was making love to it. And I remembered an ice cream from a vendor on the streets in Belfast when I was a child. The smell of the vanilla, the smell of the horses near. The scene of it so real, then, by my memory, I forgot where I was. Griffin was speaking to me, I realized, feeling philosophical. She was letting her thoughts chase themselves like a couple of playful squirrels. She asked me, I feel the time is stopping. Is it stopping? Am I just holding my breath? When I'm out of myself, I don't feel any time is passing. Is that normal? I took her hand. I caressed it, for she looked so frightened to me. I said, I do not know what time is unless it is this moment from that moment. But if you can be in two places at once, then perhaps time is conjoined, in the way that one electron is in two places at once. If space is indeterminate, is time indeterminate? Is there such a thing as a single event in time occupying two moments? One now, one before, one future. One for this person, and the other for that. But the same event. Does time have the same spread of probability that a quanta of energy has, as we have discovered it has? I think it must be so. Or space and time are inextricably bound in this material reality. And that material reality possesses this indeterminacy, this spread of potentiality, this softly blurred being of possibility. Then so must space and time. So yes, my darling one, I do believe you feel time standing still. Yes, you are holding your breath. And when your breath is held, time is held, breathlessly. Our nakedness somehow made confession natural. She said she found this still frightening. I touched her shoulder. I said to her, nothing in this should frighten you. Look at the world here. She looked where the girls were giggling together, and the roses flush with color, with aroma, a sky, a gorgeous, glassy porcelain, my basswood tree like a very old, loving woman listening. I said, you see, it is as it is. What you feel is what it is. She nodded. She seemed like she might cry. I said, eat a cookie. They're delicious. And something about my eating one, seeing me, plump pixie that I am, middle-aged as I am, in the nude, seemed suddenly very comic to her, and she laughed. And what tears she then shed were tears of an emotional happiness. The day was spent in this enchantment. We never dressed. We all enjoyed the hashish until it was gone, I promising to buy more. Then went inside to get something more savory to eat. Rachel was gone. Time did not stand still, nor was its passing regretted. But each moment of that charming day was cherished for its own. The dusk was like a dust of suspended particles of light. And once I lit the tiki torches, with all of us naked in the faded, creamy, dreamy dim, cicadas began to keenly buzz among my fragrant basswood, with their soulmate buzzing bees in this my mighty bee tree. We all looked alike, the lovely virgin sprite, whom any man would be enthralled to see, but our finding shall be forbidden him. Oh, in the loss of such a vivid dream to see, he should feel forever empty. All the birds and bugs made music of the twilight that left us wondering in delight, all us naked girls in this midsummer's night. Where the bee sucks there suck I, in a cowslip's bell I lie. There I couch when owls do cry, on the bat's back I do fly, after summer merrily. Merrily, merrily shall I live now, under the blossom that hangs on the bough, over hill, over dale, thorough bush, thorough briar, over park, over pale, thorough flood, thorough fire, I do wander everywhere, swifter than the moon's sphere, and I served a fairy queen to dew her orbs upon the green. And I see what I knew before, but of which am now unabashedly aware and warmly stare, that Zoe is freckled all over her naked body so prettily, and Cheshire Cat, asleep, is curled at my feet on the gazebo floor, where Griffin, whom I see is very angular, and her breasts and her hips, how like a griffin she, has laid upon her my crocheted afghan from my couch, while White Rabbit and Caterpillar are chasing one another merrily in and out of the doors, and bring back, as I had asked, some bottles of Puy Fumé. Gathered in the gazebo, we drank three bottles from crystal goblets, the honeyed citrus, a secret fruit, and talked softly about the smells of things, the sounds of things, the mystery of knowing nothing. And I recited then this verse of Jacoté to them. I no longer want to try to fly at the speed of time, to think one instant my awaiting motionless. Rousing Cheshire Cat, because the rest of us were feeling a little chilly, we went back into the house, turned on the lights, shut the curtains, and I turned on my stereo. We sat on the living room floor, on the cushions on the floor, and on my down sofa, and we ate fresh, ripe strawberries, dipped in a bowl of granulated sugar, while I brought out my very best Cabernet, rich as dark chocolate, and of this we drank several glasses full. We listened to Rachmaninoff, his Concerto No. 2, and we talked about men and romance, all of them confiding sad, poignant, joyous longings, until Mock Turtle asked me, "Have you ever been in love, Edith?" So sweetly, innocently asks. Of course I answer truthfully. "Yes, long ago. It was in the war." He was, how shall I describe the body he had? It was like riding my favorite horse, bareback, I think. I laughed knowingly. "Yes, I loved him very much. And he loved me. That was so long ago." I began to cry. They sympathized and caressed me, held me warmly, I said, brushing off my tears, laughing. "Ah, life is truly generous. I hope you shall all know such happiness." And seeing them blinking at me, the dear, bewildered girls, I exclaimed, "And soon?" They all laughed except poor Mock Turtle, who looked so unhappy then. But all of us seeing this cheered her with our hugs and kisses and kindly comments. 3 June, 1968. I awoke early to write my memoirs of yesterday, and rereading them, I realize again with gratitude how wonderful the day had been. We get such precious moments rarely. The girls and I shall always be closer to one another by this shared memory. I shall not work today. I shall go back to bed. And when I hear them waking, I shall get up again and make them all eggs Benedict with hollandaise and that lean Canadian bacon I got from my butcher on Saturday. And some more pouille fumé, I think.
If driving fast cars you like, if mobile.